I'll start. Okay, so welcome everybody to another book club chat covering Tragedy and Hope. And well done to everyone who stuck along this far, because it's a beast of a book. Shortly into this chapter, we're going to be hitting page 666. So just bear in mind that things might go, things might run across the room, you know, just be careful. So we're covering chapter 14, which is World War II, and it's the tide of aggression. So that would be the period of 1939 to 1941. I'll cover the introduction to that. The duration, I found it quite interesting. It runs from the 1st of September. The war started the 1st of September 1939 and finished on the 2nd of September 1945, which makes it exactly 6 years. So there's another six. It was a total war. The deaths of civilians exceeded that of combatants, and the distinctions between the two became very blurred in contrast to World War One. It must have been horrendous if a army was coming through wherever you happen to be, knowing that you know, you could actually just be lined up and shot or sent to a concentration camp. Horrendous. 17 million civilians died, and 5.4 million of them were Polish. So that's phenomenal. Let's see, on page 662, the differences between World War One and World War Two. Weapons were much the same. Offensive, defensively speaking, they were very much the same, but the way that they were used was completely different. And we'll see that the Germans, they leaped ahead in their success in this war, because they resorted to a far better use of their weaponry. They used it from a tactical point of view far more cleverly. Their opponents were still stuck in World War One mode, which essentially was, to the Germans, like being presented with half an army. So from around 1942-43, the Allies were able to leap ahead of Germany, so that it took them a while, but eventually through technological gain, they were able to get the better of Germany with regards to technology and tactics. And from 1944 and 1945, the Allies were able to reverse the tide of the Nazi aggression due to superior equipment. Once again, the sciences came to their aid, and they had fresh feet on the ground. Particularly when America entered the war. So there are three parts to the war itself, three periods. You had the first period from 39 to 41, including up to 41, where the Axis powers were dominant, and that is Japan, Germany, Italy. The second point was in 1942, you reached an equilibrium of power. And the third was the Axis retreat from 43, 44, and 45. So six complete years of total war divided into three distinct periods. So according to Quigley, the Germans were able to advance so well during 39 and 41 for two reasons. The chief reason is not because they were highly mobilized for war, but it was because Hitler didn't use orthodox financing. So the financing side of things were arranged in a sense that they weren't restricted to orthodox financing, where they had to answer to a free and fair system of economy. Rather, the political needs and the matters of pertaining to warfare dictated to the financial system, and they had to toe the line and come up with various plans. And then, of course, it was the reverse in the Allied side, where they were very much stuck to the orthodox good management of balancing the books, etc., etc. So the Germans soared ahead with regards to finance. The Allied forces were conflicted as well when it comes to the theory of warfare. They had internal indecision with regards to the military leaders about the best way to proceed in the war, what tactics to use, etc. This created sort of a it put them into a bit of a freeze, and politicians had little to base their decisions on. In Germany, they had a oneness of mind and a strong purpose driving the not just the government but the people, and they didn't have this problem. So they were able to move decisively and quickly. All right, so I'm going to just read on page 662. Sorry, 663 here. So there were different theoretical ideas regarding the role of tanks, for example. How would they use their equipment? So one theoretical dispute raged around the role of tanks in combat. Tanks were originally scattered among the infantry, both moving at a rate of speed no greater than that of a man on foot, consolidating the ground yard by yard as both moved forward. And this view of the tactical function of tanks continued to be held in high military circles in France and England until too late in 1940. The contrast is that the Germans arranged their armored divisions in columns, which would pierce through and use a pincer movement where they'd come round the sides, surround the enemy, and then the infantry would come in between and start to sort of capture enemy troops, surround them. So the Allies were still arranging themselves in rows, going across and sort of lining up their armored vehicles in layers. But a strong German column would just come and burst right through those defenses. So the Germans, interestingly enough, made use of these tactics that the Allies, interestingly, the Allies had already discussed this. They had considered that tactic, but they didn't use it. They rejected it, and the Germans took advantage of that strategy. Second theory, the poor tactics of defense and offense. So this the defensive theory, which was thought up by an Englishman, Basil Littlehart, was the most valuable proponent of it, and assumed that attack would be made in lines, as the Western powers themselves were trained to attack, and that such an attack would be very unlikely to succeed because of the great increase in firepower of modern weapons. It was argued on the basis of the experience of World War I that machine guns could hold up advancing infantry indefinitely, and that artillery fire carefully placed and ranged so that it could cover the field could prevent tanks from silencing the defensive machine guns. That was an enormous mistake, and it was very, very simple for Hitler with his tactic of columns of fast-moving tanks to shock the defenses of the enemy. The French, for example, they had the Maginot Line. It was a long fortified chain of forts that ran along the the length of France, between France and Germany. But it had gaps because some of the Low Countries would rather have avoided joining in on that line to time to protect themselves from Hitler's... they thought that doing so would inflame Hitler. And so Hitler just came through they came around the Maginot Line. The Maginot Line itself was a set of defenses, but once you got past that defense, there wasn't any depth to the defense. So once the Germans, excuse me, broke through the Maginot Line, there wasn't very much waiting for them beyond that line that was a real a threat to them. Yeah, the Maginot Line was useless against the German columns. It had no depth. Once breached, there was nothing to back up the defenses beyond that. So this defensive way of thinking quickly brings out means that because they thought their defenses were so bulletproof, the Allies just didn't bother to prepare properly for offense. They had this passive, indecisive, inactive military outlook, according to the words of Quigley. And because of this, they couldn't go on the offense. And so they really couldn't muster themselves quickly enough to respond to the attack or the invasion of Germany on Poland. Yeah, I just underlined a few little parts here. The theory of continuous defensive lines, that's another thing, is that because of this defensive pattern, this tactic, if the Germans broke through a particular defensive line, what would happen is that the mindset was to keep that line intact. So then the whole lot would retreat to then fill in that area that had been broken. And the columns just kept piercing, so the whole line just kept retreating and retreating and retreating. Once again, they didn't have the offensive mindset. They weren't really geared for it. So it just resulted in setting them up on the back foot. So it resulted in a series of constant retreats to reestablish their defensive patterns. And yeah, in a sense, if you are an army and all you can do is retreat, you're not really a full army, are you? You are half an army. And there was a third theory. The third theory was that of air power. Air power, particularly in Britain, probably in Germany too, but a lot of the pilots, a lot of the military men in the air power services, in the Air Force, they were tended to be more from the upper classes, the elites. They often were quite fanatical in the approach to how war should be conducted, and they often expressed a forceful desire to not be accountable to the other or to the rest of the armed forces. They believed that air power could quickly overpower the enemy, even within 24 hours, by simply bombing main cities, decommissioning their systems, gassing them from above, rendering the population out of action. This idea was associated with the Italian general Giulio Duhay. I don't know how you say that. It was a prevalent view of civilians which played an important role in persuading both the British and French peoples to accept the Munich Agreement. So remember the inner circle, the round table, they were gaslighting their own public, trying to scare them into believing that at any moment the Germans are going to fly over and bomb them to smithereens and gas them in order to drive appeasement, in order to build up Germany. This tactic associated with this Italian general became quite a popular view of the public. It was a far-fetched theory. It was technically something that had been tried and that had worked, but it had only been done successfully in areas that had virtually no defense. It was a ridiculous idea. In Britain and America, very influential advocates of an air force separate to that of the Navy and Army was prevalent. And their focus was on long-range strategic bombers, supported by fighter planes to defend the bombers. And they belittled the effectiveness of anti-aircraft guns. So I suppose, I don't know for sure, but I'd imagine that they had a bit of a legacy from World War One, where anti-aircraft guns were just not that very good. And you probably found that air power in World War One was unchallenged to some degree. And as we carry on the reading of the chapter, we see that the bombing, long-range bombing, particularly in the beginning of the war, didn't really yield effective results. In actual fact, what is interesting, I think it was the previous chapter, the number of airmen that would be killed on a bombing raid into Germany was almost identical to the number of civilians that got killed on the same bombing raid, with very little damage to the German infrastructure. Again, this concept of long-range bombing was not popular. It was not a strong idea in Germany, Russia, or France. And this was due to the dominant position of army officers in those countries. It was the ground forces, the ground generals, etc., that would give instructions as to what the Air Force would do. And quickly mentions that in France, air power was almost completely neglected. In Germany and Russia, air power was used to support the activities of the ground forces. The Germans used it to great effect. They focused. So the type of aircraft that they built tended to be a lot more all-rounder type craft. They didn't have, they weren't the fastest, but they were the most maneuverable. And concentrated on strategic bombing. You know, they would use the Air Force a bit like a long-range artillery to support the ground troops, which makes a whole lot more sense. One of the most feared of all of those aeroplanes was the Stukas, the dive bomber planes. And I did a little looking up online. The Germans would actually, they attached little mini propellers to the plane, and these little propellers would make that screeching sound that you might have heard watching World War II documentaries. They were put there to specifically scare the enemy. Mini propellers, interestingly, they also tended to cut back on the performance of the plane. So some of the Stukas were equipped with whistles instead of these propellers. That the Stuka plane, it flies over a spot and then it dives straight down. So the Germans could very tactfully bomb the enemy very, very precisely. And when the enemy forces on the ground heard that sound, they would have really had that sinking feeling, you know, it's going to hit. The Germans had less planes than the Allies in total, but their superiority at the time was based on quality and how they used the planes that really mattered. From the previous chapter, we learned that in general, Hitler, right up until, you know, the invasion of Austria and Czechoslovakia, his military forces were not, you know, that he didn't necessarily have the best or the biggest army. But what they did have was a very strong top-down dominant leadership and a singleness of mind. So sea power, the main idea with sea power with regards to the Allied forces was that it would be dominated by these, as quickly calls, big gun capital ships. And all the other vessels would serve as a virtually like an accessory to them, supporting them, servicing them, etc. Another big idea that was prevalent at the time was that the area that a fleet could function in was limited by the positions of its major bases. And a third view that was big is that it was also believed that no landing could be made from sea on a defended shore. So quickly just gives us the background of the military thinking of the various wings of the military. So that third point, that no landing could be made from sea on a defended shore, well, a lot of these ideas that were held in the beginning of the war, as we'll see, they were forced to rethink almost all of them during this long extended battle of attrition. So let's turn across to page 666. Is anyone getting a cold breeze on their neck yet?
I've got garlic and a cross here, so I'm okay.
Ah, that'll do it. These views that we've mentioned on the military military thinking, they were generally unchallenged. Except for strong advocates of air power, they were a little bit of a rule unto themselves. And one of these people was an American, I think, General William Mitchell, who faced a court-martial for his thinking and was actually forced to resign. So it's almost like he was being a heretic. There were still, I suppose, a lot of older men in the military from the First World War who they knew how to do things, and you weren't allowed to argue too much with them, I imagine. Ultimately, previous held ideas of air, land, and sea had to be drastically modified. All right, so the Battle of Poland, moving on, that was the first official country that Germany targeted in the as the World War got started. It was the 1st of September 1939. Germany, due to their superior tactics and coordination, they started off early in the morning of that day with very, very powerful air attacks, very strategic. They went for all the important targets that would cripple an enemy's military. They went for the airfields, assembly points, railroads. They annihilated the Polish Air Force, destroying 377 planes. So, you know, the Air Force couldn't even get off the ground to respond to the Germans. And this, of course, was in partnership with the rapid advances of the armored tank divisions. Hard and fast, they really hit Poland with a, what would you call it, a blitzkrieg. Poland didn't have time to respond. Their communications were also mostly destroyed. And so, although they had a reasonably sound and substantial army, they had quite a few divisions. They had armored division. They were a decent fighting force, but they couldn't coordinate their fighting units. So they were just overrun by the Germans. Read now, page 667. So although Britain and France declared war on Germany on September the 3rd, it cannot be said that they made war during the next 2 weeks in which fighting raged in Poland. British airplanes roamed over Germany, dropping leaflets for propaganda purposes, and French patrols ventured into the space between the Maginot Line and the German West Wall. But no support was given to Poland. Although France had 3 million men under arms, and Hitler had left only 8 regular divisions on his western border, no attack was made by France. I underlined this twice. Strict orders were issued to the British Air Force not to bomb any German land forces. And these orders were not modified until April 1940. So similar orders by Hitler to the Luftwaffe were maintained for part of the same period. When some British members of Parliament, led by Amory, put pressure on the government to drop bombs on German munition stores in the Black Forest, the Air Minister, Sir H. Kingsley Wood, rejected the suggestion with asperity, declaring, "Are you aware it is private property? Why, you'll be asking me to bomb Essen next." Essen was the home of the Krupp munitions factories. That's a very, very odd thing to say. I actually made a little note later on in the book, in the chapter, where I said, if you had to, I've come to the conclusion, that I think that Hitler, judging by some of his very strange decisions he made, as you'll see later on, he was working with, he must have been working with Chatham House. I got a feeling if you had to just interchange when you see the word Hitler with Chatham House, it might make more sense, because a lot of very, very strange decisions were made that were all seemingly falling right into the hands of the round table groups. And of course, we know at the end of World War II, Hitler's body wasn't found, and he is supposedly known to have escaped to Argentina, which could mean that, you know, just like Bin Laden, who was flown out of New York, perhaps, you know, it was the Anglo-American establishment once again shipping old Hitler out of town. We'll never really know, but I have a suspicion that that is probably more true. Similar efforts to force the French to take some action against Germany were rejected on the ground that this might irritate the Germans so that they would strike back at the Western powers. So appeasement was still going on well into World War II. So we see that Winston Churchill steps in here. The British public and the English Parliament were starting to really wanting to push back now. What is going on? Why aren't we dealing with Hitler? And so they brought in Winston Churchill as Lord of the Admiralty to kick off the war. Before World War II, Winston Churchill was generally despised by most of the rest of the political class. But he was known for being a bit of a what's the word I'm looking for? Well, regardless, he was the man of the time to give Hitler what was needed. So they made Churchill Lord of the Admiralty. It was primarily to quiet the English Parliament. The British Navy, we learn, was so slow in getting going that this allowed time for German battleships to leave their ports. At this stage, nothing is a coincidence anymore as I read this book. As far as I'm concerned, it was a strategic thing. They let them out the gate. So blockades against Germany were half-hearted.
Can I just add something there? Churchill actually bombed and destroyed the whole French Navy, saying that he was worried about the Germans taking it over. So that sort of ties in here a little bit.
Definitely, Greg. Yeah. Yeah, it's, for instance, with the blockade, you know, it was so half-hearted because essentially for weeks on end during the Polish invasion, French iron ore was being passed through the Low Countries, and they were exchanging, they were trading. And this trade continued for weeks until Hitler, with Hitler forbidding his forces to, you know, just steer clear of the Western frontier. Don't interfere. So there's just more coordination to all this that comes out, and you've got the Chatham House group sort of gaslighting their public, pushing for appeasement to the most ridiculous levels. You've got Hitler, who would pretend to reject the appeasement, sorry, the concessions. He would push for more and more ridiculous requests. Funny enough, Hitler just keeps doing exactly what the round table groups want, whilst at the same time being the enemy. So as Poland was collapsing, without a hand being raised to help it, the Soviet Union was invited by Hitler to invade Poland from the east and occupy the areas which had been granted to it in the Soviet-German agreement of August 23rd. The Russians were eager to move in order to ensure that the Germans stop as far as possible from the Soviet frontiers. But they were desperately afraid that if they did enter Poland, the Western powers might declare war on Russia in support of their guarantee to Poland and would then wage war against the Soviet Union while not fighting Germany, or even while allowing economic and military aid to go to Germany. So I get my overall impression is that Hitler and the inner circle of the roundtable groups were quite well acquainted with each other, more than we are let on. And it appears that the Russians were actually the ones that were played for a little bit of a dupe, I think, anyway. And accordingly, the Kremlin held up its invasion of Poland until September the 17th. A little legal matter whereby the Polish government petitioned Romania to seek refuge in Romania technically meant that because Poland no longer had a government on the soil of Poland, that it would then not constitute an act of aggression if Russia moved in. So there's your legalism for you. The people don't really matter. It's the government. The Soviet leaders, they sought to justify their advance into Polish territory with the excuse that they must restore order and provide protection for the Ruthenian and white Russian peoples of eastern Poland. We learn that the Soviet and the Nazi military, the armies, met together. You'll find photographs of, the two groups of military leaders and soldiers having a great old camaraderie. And so they were very much allies at the time. On September 28th, a new agreement was made between Molotov and Ribbentrop, dividing Poland. Accordingly, Lithuania was shifted into the Soviet sphere, while in Poland itself, the German sphere was extended eastward from the Vistula to the Bug River along the old Curzon line, because Russia wanted to follow the nationality boundary. And that is the Polish invasion. Melissa, would you like to take the next?
Okay. This next section is called the Sitz Creek, September 1939 to May 1940. And Sitz Krieg is sitting war. And it says the period from the end of the Polish campaign to the German attack on Denmark and Norway on April the 9th, 1940, is frequently called the Sitz Krieg, sitting war, or even the phony war, because the Western powers made no real effort to fight Germany. These powers were eager to use the slow process of economic blockade as their chief weapon in order to avoid casualties. There was something that I was wanting to find out yesterday about something called the War Production Board, which I'll get to. And I remembered that I read a biography of Bernard Baruch, I don't know, about a year and a half or two ago. And then the title of it was called Mr. Baruch. And it just so happened that what I was looking for on the war board, the pages that followed, there was a description there by the author. I think her name was Helen Lawrence. But at any rate, she said, "We called the war phony. Only the fall of France and Belgium, the tourists' playgrounds, had meaning for the United States. America at large cared little, apparently, about the men, women, and children of Poland who fled like hunted animals through roads clogged with trucks, wagons, cars, and cavalry soldiers, now racing, running, trying to hide under a searing sky in the open fields under the shadow of wings that soared and swooped, and the drilling of machine gun fire and bombs ripping furrows or graves ahead of them. Dust blew in clouds. It powdered the dry tongues of babies strapped to motorcycles or slung in sidecars. It stung and inflamed their eyes. Flies swarmed. There were no places to rest in the cowering little villages, no places to bathe in or prepare milk or food except in the homes of kindly strangers who might themselves be fleeing a few hours later. Faces were wan and worn. Eyes were dry and seemingly sightless, but no one wept. One observer recorded that their eyes would haunt her always. Poland had been a battleground for centuries, lashed and cut like wheat for the harvest, but never before like this. The bombs hurtling down on the train of women, children, and wounded soldiers lumbering out of Krakow, again and again, shuddering to a stop for the bodies to be brought out, 10 and 12 at a time. Refugees were fleeing across the border. They were not afraid of death, but of living under the Nazis or Russians. And for Americans, it was a phony war." It was not phony to Baruch, who read the eyewitness accounts sent to him by Mrs. Roosevelt. He's an interesting character. I'll mention him again in relation to the war board. But this is interesting. I don't think that the British had the same idea necessarily once it came to them. I don't know what the French were thinking before it got to them, but it is interesting that they said, you know, Americans only cared when it was destroying their little playgrounds. Otherwise, they wanted to stay out. Hitler seemed to think that he wanted Poland. He now had Poland, and there was no reason to continue fighting. And so he offered peace, which was rejected by the Western powers. They were determined to destroy Hitler. This was, you made a point there about Hitler, you could just say is interchangeable with Chatham House or Round Table. And I think that that is an interesting assertion, and one that in many ways I think was shared by Alan, who his reading had shown him that Hitler was genuinely surprised that various overtures that he made to the West, particularly to Britain, were rejected. He felt that there was an agreement there that we just have to assume was more than tacit, and that he was doing his part and he had done it. And so why now? Quigley said, well, Chamberlain in particular had a personal issue with Hitler because he had destroyed his appeasement goals. But I think it was deeper than that. So they're talking about how slowly Germany itself mobilized because, again, did Hitler think this was going to go on past Poland? It said both the U.S. and Britain's military production was higher than Germany. The economic production in Germany was supposed to have been carried out by someone named Fritz Todt. He was an engineer who was in charge of the construction of the West Wall. He was killed in an airplane crash in February of 1942, and his successor was Albert Speer. And it goes into a description of the reasons why Speer's mobilization plans were slowed down. It said that he had great organizational ability, but he had to share his functions, and that would have meant his organizational teams, anything that he wanted resources for, he was sharing with other committees and groups. There was Goring's 4-year plan organization. There was a central planning board, and Speer was one of 4 men on that who had powers of top allocation for, you know, material resources, but he had no control over labor. And again, he was sharing this with other organizational bodies. It said that the SS took over a great deal of war production because they had the labor. They had concentration camp labor. And Britain was applying economic warfare towards Germany, but this was applied slowly. And the way they describe it, it was across the board rather than on resources that would have really hurt. It said Germany began the war in September 1939. Less than a third of its oil, rubber, and iron ore were of domestic origin. It only had 2 months' supply of gasoline at the peacetime rate of consumption and about 3 months' supply of aviation fuel. It goes on to tell you that though they weren't that well equipped and they didn't have that many resources, because they weren't getting pressure from Britain that was sustained and well thought out, Germany was able to use the resources and eventually, after France particularly, the manpower labor of their conquered territories. It talked about their U-boats and the attacks there. It said that the British were trying to control contraband and place restrictions on German imports to give a burden to the Navy. Germany was not prepared for sea battles at all. And so there were essentially, in the beginning, there were some good successes there. But it said as far as the U-boats were concerned, there was no improvement in the situation until the latter half of 1941. The U-boat sinkings were averaging 7 a month, but Germany had the replacement capacity of 15 per month that they were building. So they were managing to build up their U-boat supply in spite of the fact that Britain appeared to be giving it the best effort to take them out. Britain was also heavily involved in detaining any ship, and at a certain point they were bringing in the U.S. into this project, and they were detaining ships that were suspected of carrying contraband, and Britain issued what they called passports that a commercial shipping had to have. They were called Navy certs. It said here, in contraband control work, suspicious merchant vessels were forced to put into a control harbor for search of their cargoes. Control points were placed in Canada, in the Mediterranean, in the north of Scotland, and elsewhere, but the United States would not permit one in the Caribbean area. When vessels being detained began to clog up these ports, whole categories of vessels then became exempt from control. So if you think about that, they didn't have the manpower or the facility to check these vessels for contraband. So they simply said, oh, okay, well, you can go. We'll just take you out there. You're not one we're going to stop and check anymore. Eventually, they got into freezing assets of the aggressor powers. In order to reduce the enemy's ability to buy abroad, financial connections were cut. The enemy's funds abroad were frozen. His exports, were blocked. The United States cooperated in these efforts as well, freezing the financial assets of various nations as they were conquered by the aggressor powers, and finally the assets of the aggressors themselves in June, July 1941. Another interesting comment that Quigley makes about the blockade, both the blockade of ships, actual ships suspected of carrying contraband, and economic blockade, was that Britain enforced this with little regard to law. So Britain didn't care. There was neutral rights, international law, and there was very little protest about this. They just went about it and did it.
Melissa, can I add something?
Sure.
Once again, referring back to trading with the enemy, mentions this part of the contraband and shipping goods back and forth. The Germans had quite a few shill corporations in the United States, and there were some very interesting, important characters that have been mentioned earlier in Tragedy and Hope that were trading with the enemy, and they would use their own shipping. So you probably find that the reason why they didn't have this search system in the Caribbean was to allow that process to go smoothly. And they were sort of round-tripping stocks and things from the States down to South America, then going round. And they were given a free pass. I think it's largely got to do with this the Caribbean. It's quite interesting.
That is interesting. Thanks. So an important thing that happened prior to the beginning of the war, the invasion of Poland, was the Nazi-Soviet trade agreement. And this was entered into on August 19, 1939. And I won't go in with all of the details of what they were supposed to be trading back and forth, but it promised that Germany would provide 200 million marks credit to be used for machinery and industrial installations for Russia in return for Russian raw materials to the value of 180 million marks. And he outlines how that was used. But one of the seeming problems is that Germany got more from the Soviet Union. So it was a lopsided agreement. The Soviet Union, Germany got behind on payments. The Soviet Union was upset about this, and they kept demanding that Germany catch up on payments and on this trade agreement for materials that Germany was using and getting. And Hitler's reaction to this was to attack the Soviets. So a lot of that leading up to Hitler's attack on the Soviet Union had to do with, we just don't want to honor this agreement. What successes there were in the blockade against Germany, it said that the Germans coped very well with this because they had a high level of engineering skill and because of their ruthless exploitation of conquered Europe, which I mentioned earlier. Wherever they occupied or went through, they immediately took all of the resources of the area and also used the manpower. So they basically had a slave system or indentured servant system wherever they went that contributed to helping them, even though, as Quigley pointed out, they didn't have as many planes or tanks or any, you know, it appeared to be lopsided, but that did not slow them down. As you pointed out, Darren, they also had a unity of spirit that they They were unified in that way. We come to the Soviet borderlands section. This is September 1939 to April of 1940. And I'll just read a little bit of the first paragraph here. It said, during the phony war from September 1939 to April 1940, there were persons in Britain, France, and Germany who were willing to fight to the bitter end, and other persons who were eager to make peace. Such persons engaged in extensive intrigues and cross intrigues in order to negotiate peace or to prevent it. One of the most publicized of these efforts gave rise to the so-called Venlo incident of November 1939. And without covering the details of this, this appeared to be an agent or a double agent from the German general staff who approached two members of British military intelligence and said that they wanted to discuss the possibility of peace. They spent several days doing this, and then when it appeared that they were close to negotiating this peace, one of the Germans killed one of the British attachés and then basically kidnapped a couple of more people and took them out, I think, to Berlin. I'm not sure. But that he quickly said this was just one example, and he said, on the whole, a rather unimportant one, of a number of unsuccessful efforts to make peace between the Western powers and Germany in the 6 months following the defeat of Poland. These efforts, combined with the lack of fighting in the, quote, phony war, to convince the leaders of the Soviet Union that the Western powers had little heart in fighting Germany and would prefer to be fighting Russia. As we shall see, this was probably true of Chamberlain and his close associates, and of Daladier and his successor as Prime Minister of France, Paul Reynaud. To avoid or at least postpone an attack from either the Western powers or Germany became the chief aim of Soviet policy. Another thing that was another situation or pressure point, I guess you could say, for the Soviet Union was what was going on in the Far East. They sustained two attacks by the Japanese army on Soviet territory. I think that was, I guess, in the period 1938 to 1939. They also had a spy. The Soviets had a spy in Japan, and I don't know how to pronounce his name, but it's Richard Sorge or Sorge, and he was very effective. He had Nazi associations. He was very well connected in Japan, and his intelligence allowed the Soviets to weaken their defenses in the Far East and strengthen them in Europe. So though they had sustained these attacks from Japan, the overall intel was that there wasn't so much of a threat there and they could put their attention elsewhere. And at this time, the Soviet leaders were worried about the Balkans, the Caspian oil fields, and they were also fearful of an Anglo-French attack. In the Baltic, they were fearful of Western powers and of Germany. The situation, as quickly tells us, in the Balkans was precarious. I'm going to actually read a little section here because I found the maneuvering that was going on in points of the world that we don't hear that much about is interesting. There was a lot going on in these early months of the war. It said the political situation in the Balkans was of such precarious stability that the Western powers did not dare to make a move in the area for fear everything would collapse. Turkey, Greece, Romania, and Yugoslavia were joined in a Balkan entente aimed at preventing any Bulgarian aggression. since these four states could mobilize over 100 divisions, although lacking all modern or heavy equipment, they could keep Bulgaria quiet. Unfortunately, the Balkan Entente was not designed for protection against Italy or Germany, where the real danger lay. Italy had various projects to attack Greece from the Albanian territory it had seized in April 1939. It also had fully matured plans to disrupt Yugoslavia by subsidizing and supporting a Croat revolt under Ante Pavelic against the dominant Serb majority in that state. During the, quote, phony war, the Italians hoped that the Western powers would allow Italy to carry out its project against Yugoslavia in order to block any German movement into that area. Such permission seemed possible from the fact that the three democratic states had not guaranteed Yugoslavia as they had the other three states of the Balkan Entente. Italy's project was set for early June 1940, but was interrupted by Hitler's attack in the West, which was made without notifying his Italian partner on May the 10th. And he goes on in this section on that page with even more of these intrigues. But he makes an important point here. He said Hitler wanted nothing from the Balkans or the Soviet Union, but the maximum supply of raw materials. The Soviet Union took steps to defend itself against the Balkans. Finland was a bigger problem than the Balkans. Leningrad was joined to the Baltic by the Gulf of Finland. On October the 14th, the Soviet Union demanded the restructuring of the Finnish frontier and other concessions. And at the same time, and it's just kind of when you read it and you see what they wanted, it's this whole area there. It tells you how long it was, how many miles wide, where it ran, what it was bordered by. And the Soviet Union just said, we want that. Give it to us. At the same time, they offered Finland a non-aggression pact. So that was the sweetening of the deal. Give us everything that we're asking for territorially, and we won't bother you. We won't attack. Finland rejected the Soviet demands. And they were having some kind of negotiation. It went on for several days or weeks. I'm not sure here of the time, but they were together with Finnish representatives and Soviet representatives, and then they took some time off, or they just went home. I'm not sure. And it quickly said, for some unexplained reason, the Finns seemed to have felt that the Russians would not attack their country. But indeed, that is what the Soviets did. They attacked on the 29th of November. Quigley writes, if the Finns had misrepresented the Soviet determination to attack, the Soviets misrepresented the Finnish determination to resist. And this war, which is called the Winter War, or Winter War, has been very well documented, and you can look it up. But I do recommend a really good movie that I saw a few years ago called The Winter War. It's from 1989, and it does show you how intensely the Finnish soldiers fought. And there's interesting things there, too, that you don't often see in a war movie, like their use of white uniforms, so that was their camouflage in the snow. I did notice that there was another award-winning Finnish movie from 2017 or 2018 that was supposed to be a good representation, fictional as this was basically a fictional account, but based on a lot of truth. So the Finnish men fought very hard. And the result of how hard they fought is that they saved Finland from being occupied by the Soviets. So they did have to make a peace. The Soviets installed a puppet government, and Britain and France resurrected the League of Nations to boot the Soviet Union out over this aggression. And in the book, there is an interesting description, it's fairly lengthy, of the response to the Western response to this aggression, and the fact that it was just interesting too quickly that they wanted to punish the Soviet Union swiftly and aggressively, firmly over this, whereas they had let so many other aggressors, hadn't bothered to take them to the league. But anyway, it talks about the puppet government a bit. It said France and Britain attempted to turn the Soviet attack on Finland into a general war against Russia. They prepared, or they said that they were preparing, an expeditionary force of 100,000 soldiers. That was France and Britain. Meanwhile, there was a German-Swedish trade agreement that this was bringing in the important seaport of Narvik. And Germany began making plans to seize Norway. Quigley writes that the Anglo-French expeditionary force was really to attack Russia. So they, I think that the ostensible reason was to come to the aid of Finland, but it was not really to be that defensive aid, but an offensive force against the Soviet Union. Now, it's interesting, too, that Britain and France pressured Finland to keep fighting. And the whole, I just called them here, the machinations leading up to the Soviet-Finnish peace treaty were quite interesting. Quigley writes, they actually did, I said they did all they could in my notes here, to encourage Finland to keep fighting. But Quigley writes, Britain and France did all they could to force Finland to continue to fight until they could arrive on the scene. In February, word was sent that if Finland made peace, the two Western powers would not be bound to support Finnish independence after the Great War ended. On January the 3rd, the British ambassador was withdrawn from Moscow. And on February 26th, Lord Halifax rejected a Soviet request that Britain convey its peace terms to Finland. So Halifax said, no, we're not going to take your peace offer to Finland. So they had to send it through Sweden. On March the 4th, Daladier and Lord Ironsides formally promised Finland an expeditionary force of 57,000 men. The Scandinavian countries put pressure on Finland not to ask for troops and informed Britain that they would tear up their railroad tracks if the expeditionary force tried to cross. The request did not come from the Finns, and so Daladier sent them a threatening message and said, I assure you, once more, we are ready to give our help immediately. The airplanes are ready to take off. The operational force is ready. If Finland does not now make her appeal to the Western powers, it is obvious that at the end of the war, the Western powers cannot assume the slightest responsibility for the final settlement regarding Finnish territory. It's just interesting because whatever was going on there, Finland was acting alone against the wishes of every other major power there. Eventually, they made their peace. They ignored all of these threats that said the Soviet-Finnish peace treaty of March 12, 1940 was made at the insistence of the Finnish commander-in-chief, Baron Mannerheim, although it was much more severe than the Russian demands of October. So they were successful there. The next section is called the German attack on Denmark and Norway, April 1940. Hitler's orders to attack France were given and reversed a half a dozen times between September 1939 and May 1940. And this is, I'm just read a little section here because it gives it some insight into Hitler's way of waging war. Each of these orders, so at least a half a dozen orders that were given and then withdrawn, each of these orders was reported to the West through the Dutch military attaché in Berlin. But as no attack eventuated, it is probable that faith in this informant declined. Information also came from other sources. One was an Italian foreign minister who said that there was an attack being prepared. In January, a German plane with operational orders for the attack made an emergency landing in Belgium. The orders were captured before they could be destroyed completely. This caused great alarm in the West, but no one could be sure if the captured documents were authentic or part of a Nazi false alarm. In the meantime, from December 1939 onward, plans to invade Norway were prepared at the insistence of the German admirals. These plans were made in cooperation with Major Vidkun Quisling, a former Norwegian minister of war and a leader of the insignificant Nazi party in Norway. And that is interesting because through the remainder of the war and afterwards, you hear of a collaborator or, you know, from another country, a cooperator being called a Quisling. Finally, formal orders were issued by Hitler March the 1st, 1940 to occupy Denmark and Norway. Denmark yielded April 9. That same morning, German agents who had obviously already been brought into Norway seized Norwegian airfields, radio stations, and docks. Allied expeditionary forces prepared for Finland, then committed to Norway, Trondheim, and Narvik. The Trondheim expeditionary action was badly bungled, and the British naval losses were heavy. And this is key to the changing of the guard, because it was thought, perceived, and that it was Chamberlain who was responsible for these heavy British naval losses. And so Churchill ended up replacing him. And then, but I'll read this little section because, or parts of it at the end here. The Norwegian fiasco brought Britain's increasingly restive public opinion to the boiling point. In the parliamentary debate of May 7 through the 10th, Chamberlain feebly defended his policies, but was subjected to a devastating attack from all sides. The high point was reached when Leopold Amery, repeating Cromwell's words to the Long Parliament, cried at Chamberlain, "You have sat too long here for any good you have been doing. Depart, I say. Let us have done with you. In the name of God, go." In the following vote of confidence, Chamberlain was victorious, 281 to 200, but his nominal majority of 200 had fallen to 81, equivalent to a defeat. The next day, May 9, 1940, the Speaker was very busy preventing the honorable members from continuing their attack on Chamberlain. On May the 10th, at dawn, the German army struck westward against the Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, and France, and Chamberlain resigned. He was replaced by a national government under Winston Churchill. So the next section is called The Fall of France, and this is May to June 1940, and the Vichy regime. The French campaign was dominated by the Maginot Line and Plan D. And Darren has already given us a bit of an introduction to the Maginot Line. It was a series of elaborate and expensive permanent fortifications. Plan D was the idea that if there was a German attack on the Low Countries, that would be met by Allied forces that would advance so quickly, or as quickly as possible, to meet the enemy. The French anticipated that the Germans would use a modified Schlieffen Plan of 1905. That would be a wide sweep through the Low Countries. False alarms of German attacks in the winter of 1939 to 1940 showed that the Allied forces would meet with a rapid advance into Belgium, and that Germany would strike with greatest strength at Sedan. What happened was that the Germans had intelligence. They understood what was happening. They also understood how this Maginot Line worked. So there were these permanent expensive fortifications, and quickly lays out in great detail that, I think it was 60 of 100 units were behind the Maginot Line, and it was neither defensive nor offensive, successfully, because my understanding, I'm sorry, I'm not a war strategist, but my understanding is that defensively they were over-concentrated in certain areas, and offensively they couldn't really move. They couldn't go forward to attack because they were behind all of these fortifications and they had nothing to defend them or fortify them if they went on the offensive. So Germany seems to have been aware of this weakness in the planning and also exactly what the Allied forces would do on their rapid advance. And they did something that the French thought was impossible, which was they did a pass through the Ardennes forest and crossed the swift Meuse River. And apologies for my pronunciation. You always hope that you're going to have time to educate yourself on how something is supposed to sound, but that's what happened. This Manstein plan was a total surprise to France, and the German attack began early on May the 10th. 2 days later, they broke through the Dutch defenses with their Panzer Division. Just read a little bit here about pinning down the French army. Belgium's forces fell backward toward the Dyle, that's a river, as the French and British units, according to Plan D, wheeled northeastward on Sedan as a pivot to meet them. As the Belgian forces withdrew northwest, while the German attack swung southwest, the main burden of the German assault now fell on the French First Army to pin it down and thus prevent it from reinforcing Korps further south. In this, the Germans were successful on May the 15th. As news of the breakthrough at Sedan became known, Gamelin ordered all forces in Belgium to fall backward from the Dyle line toward the Scheldt. We're going to go on here and get a lot more detail on Hitler's advance, Germany's advance into France. But one of the upshots of this was that Renault replaced Daladier as Minister of Defense. He had obviously hadn't done a good job. And the chief face of defense now was an 83-year-old man named Marshal Pétain. And it was assumed, or at least Quigley writes, that this Pétain was to play the role that Hindenburg had played in Germany, and that was to protect vested and business interests from the left in a period of defeat. What we see here is that at the highest levels, in almost immediately, France was defeated by Germany, and they weren't regrouping to see what they could do to fight back or coordinate better. There was also, as you read here, just a woeful lack of communication between France and their allies. It's kind of mind-boggling, really. But what the strategy seemed to be was, let's us, the ruling class, protect ourselves. We've got Weygand on his unsuccessful effort to make a coordinated attack, and the German breakthrough again of the Belgian army in a different location. And then at this point, King Leopold of Belgium makes an unconditional surrender on May the 27th. So here, the British Expeditionary Force began to evacuate through Dunkirk. And Weygand tried to form a new line along two rivers, the Somme and another river. And the Battle of France began June the 5th, and the line collapsed. So they gave up before it started, as near as we can tell. The German units roamed at will on captured fuel. Weygand requested the government to seek an armistice. Reynaud refused civilian surrender, and he also rejected military capitulation. And this is interesting. I'm not sure what kind of surrender he was thinking, but Reynaud wanted to keep a French army as a guarantee against economic or social changes in France. Reynaud sent 18 messages to Churchill for help, which were not answered, and his appeals to Roosevelt were not successful. And I know that Greg piped in earlier, and there may be some people in the group who have a better understanding of this than I do, but I found this really interesting. Quigley writes that the chief concern for London and Washington was the fate of the French fleet and also North and West Africa. The concern was that if the French fleet were combined with the Italian and the German navies, then that could destroy the British sea defenses, force a British surrender, and it would place America in great danger. A German occupation of French North and West Africa would close the British route through the Mediterranean, and it would allow Italian forces in Libya to invade Egypt. It's just an odd background, both internally in France and externally with the British and the Americans. It said, Quigley wrote that the Washington and London did what they could to dissuade Mussolini from attacking France and persuade the French to avoid any armistice which would yield French Africa or the French fleet to Hitler. The armistice negotiations were concluded on the 25th of June, and I'll just read a little section here on page 690. The armistice negotiations were conducted on a railway carriage. Hitler was so convinced that Britain would also make peace that he gave surprisingly lenient terms to France. In spite of Mussolini's demands, France did not have to give up any overseas territory or any ports on the Mediterranean, no naval vessels or any airplanes or armaments to be used against England. Northern France and all the western coast to the Pyrenees came under occupation, but the rest was left unoccupied, ruled by a government free from direct German control and policed by French armed forces. The chief burden of the surrender came from three provisions. One, the division of the country into two zones with about two-thirds of French productive capacity in the occupied zone. Two, all French prisoners of war, amounting to almost 2 million men, were to remain in German hands until the final peace treaty, while German prisoners were to be released at once. And the third term of the surrender was that all the expenses of the German occupation were to be paid by unoccupied France. The two zones were sealed off so completely that even postal communication was reduced to a minimum. This crippled the economy of the unoccupied part. The expenses of the army of occupation were set at the outrageous sum of 400 million francs a day. Moreover, by fixing the exchange rate at 1 Reichsmark for 20 francs in place of the pre-war rate of 1 for 11 francs, it became possible for the occupying forces to buy goods very cheaply in France, thus draining wealth to Germany. The governmental system of Vichy France was a kind of bureaucratic tyranny. Pierre Laval pushed through a series of constitutional laws which ended the Third Republic and the parliamentary system, combining in the hands of Marshal Pétain the joint functions of head of the state, which was formerly held by the president, and the head of government, which was formerly held by the prime minister, and also gave him the right to legislate by decree. Laval was designated as Pétain's successor in holding these powers, and the parliamentary chambers were dismissed. The ideology, I'm skipping just a little bit here on, this is on page 691. The ideology of Vichy was a typical fascist mélange of nationalism, social solidarity, anti-Semitism, anti-democracy, anti-communism, opposition to class conflicts, to liberalism, or to secularism, with resounding blasts on the virtues of discipline, self-sacrifice, authority, and repentance, but all these things meant very little to either the rulers or the ruled of the new regime. In general, corruption and intrigue, idealism and self-sacrifice were about as prevalent under Vichy as they had been under the Third Republic, but secrecy was more successful. Civil liberties were absent. The distance between propaganda and behavior was, if anything, wider, and hypocrisy replaced cynicism as the chief vice of politicians. It said that the two strongest characteristics of the regime were a hatred for the Third Republic and a hatred of England. London, meanwhile, tried to build up de Gaulle as a leader of the Free French. Washington, on the other hand, gave de Gaulle no support, and they recognized the Vichy government. They both, the London and Washington, maintained observers in North Africa, and this ended up supplying valuable military and economic information leading up to the Allied invasion of North Africa on the 8th of November, 1942. And that takes us, Darren, to the Battle of Britain.